Welcome to this edition of Back to Basics with Pastor Brian Broderson.
This is the scandal of grace. You see, when we really grab hold of the radical grace of God, for some people it's scandalous because it seems like, wait, what are you saying? That God's just going to forgive that person? But don't you know what they've done and how horrible they've been? And you're going to say that God can just wipe that away? Well, that's grace.
Today on Back to Basics, Pastor Brian continues his series, Jesus Encounters. Join us as Pastor Brian begins his teaching on John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, as he examines an encounter between Jesus and the woman who was a sinner. Now, here's Pastor Brian.
We are continuing today in our series, Jesus Encounters, and we're looking at this wonderful story here, and our message is entitled, Jesus and the Woman Who Was a Sinner. And just on a personal note, this passage is one that is so, from my perspective, it's just such a beautiful story. I've always loved this story, just the beauty of the way Jesus so graciously deals with this woman who is obviously a sinner. And in the story, we get a picture of Jesus's dealings with sinners. And so that's part of what we're doing as we're going through this series here. But An interesting note that we have to start on today is that as great as the story is, it's a controversial story in that there's a theological debate or a scholarly debate as to whether this story is true. I don't know if you realize that or not. If you have a newer Bible version that you're using, you might even see it. Maybe you've seen it already, but you might see it as you look down there. There might be a footnote that says, this is true in most newer translations, that says that, or something like, the earliest manuscripts do not include this portion, chapter 7, verse 53 through 8:11. And the reason why these newer versions of the Bible put that in there is because the passage is not found in most of the earliest manuscripts. But the passage is found in the majority of manuscripts. And so the question is this a legitimate, authentic story? Did this really happen? Or is this something that was just made up and inserted into the text later, as some would suggest? So among scholars, there are three theories. The first theory is the one that I just mentioned, that the passage is an invention and an insertion from a later period. It is fraudulent. It didn't happen. John did not include it in his original gospel. There are scholars who absolutely believe that. And so that's why you have that little disclaimer in the newer versions of the Bible. Now, there's also scholars who see the passage as authentic. The events recorded did indeed happen, but it was probably originally found in Luke or one of the other synoptic gospels. So again, they don't see it as being part of John, even though they do believe it's authentic. They see it as maybe being part of Luke. Some say maybe part of Matthew. But then there's a third group of scholars, and they believe, and I stand with them in this, they believe that it belongs right here where we find it. It is original to John. He included it because it really did happen, just as he says. And the reason some of the oldest manuscripts do not contain it is because they were tampered with and it was erased. That, I think, is actually the case. And someone as illustrious in church history as Augustine, he believed the same thing, and so did Ambrose and Jerome. But Augustine said this regarding the passage. He said, "Some were afraid of the passage, lest it should lead to laxity of morals, and so had erased it from their manuscripts." So that's a pretty straightforward and serious accusation there that Augustine makes. But of course, if you've heard that name, Augustine, or sometimes pronounced Augustine, many people would recognize him as a leading authority in the history of the church. He not only said that about the text, he wrote commentary on each of the verses of the text. He preached from the passage several times. He obviously believed that it was authentic. And even though there is this scholarly debate that's gone on, I think that Augustine's position is the accurate one. Let me just quote to you another writer. He said this. He said that such an event did happen, and that we have an authentic record of what occurred is accepted by the great bulk of critics. So the majority of the critics, they do see it as authentic. Nevertheless, they expunge it from the text of John. So for some reason, they just don't think that it should be a part of John. But this writer goes on, he says, "The difficulty, however, is one indication of the surpassing originality of the narrative. It is hard to imagine the motive which would induce any of the followers of Christ or of John to have invented it. While there are reasons drawn from the ascetic tendencies mighty at work in certain sections of the church for its omission." So this writer says, let me just translate what he said for you. He says, it's hard to imagine that somebody would invent this story. And, you know, I have read both sides of this argument for years. And, you know, some of the scholars say, oh, well, the Greek here is it's not exactly like John normally, you know, would use the Greek. And so we see a discrepancy there. And some would say it doesn't really fit with the story. It sort of breaks into the story and you lose the continuity of the story. And all of those to me are just, I just don't agree with them. But what this guy is saying is that, you know, it's hard to imagine somebody inventing this story. The story just has this ring of authenticity. But then he says, but it's not, in other words, what he's saying, it's not hard to imagine that it would have been omitted from the text. Why? Because of the ascetic tendencies that were mighty at work in certain sections of the church. So let me explain that. In certain sections of the church, a couple hundred years after the apostolic age, asceticism came in. And now asceticism is the idea that it comes from Greek philosophy, basically, and it's the idea that the physical material universe is all corrupted and evil, and therefore the body is corrupted and evil thoroughly, and therefore the body and all of its natural desires and so forth are corrupted and evil, and there should never be any kind of enjoyment or pleasure derived from the body because of the evil nature of the body. So that teaching crept into the church early on. And so what Augustine said and what is being said here is that it was the people who had that mindset that would have omitted this because they saw in it too much grace for a sinner. They feared that if this remained in the text, that it would just sort of, you know, give people, and particularly women, the idea that they could actually go commit adultery and be forgiven by God. So they wanted to make sure that that didn't happen. So I personally think that that's exactly what we have with this controversy that developed. But think about this with me for just a second. Jesus was not only too radical for the Jewish religious leaders in showing mercy to sinners. We've talked about that before. And all through the Gospels, you find, remember, one of the big stumbling blocks for the religious leaders of the day regarding Jesus was that he associated too closely with sinners. They accused him of that all of the time. But not only was he a stumbling block for the Jewish leaders, apparently he was also too radical for some of the early church leaders. So isn't this crazy to think about it? That, you know, Jesus, who brings to us the gospel of God's grace, and the New Testament is written, the theme of the New Testament is the grace of God. Yet a couple hundred years down the road, the grace of God has been so distorted and so blurred that this story becomes a scandal to church leaders. They're like, no, Jesus couldn't have done this. This is way too much grace. That would be their actual thinking behind it. So Jesus showing mercy to a sinful woman results in these church leaders being stumbled. This is the scandal of grace. You see, when we really grab hold of the radical grace of God, for some people it's scandalous because it seems like, what are you saying? That God's just going to forgive that person? But don't you know what they've done and how horrible they've been? And you're going to say that God can just wipe that away? Well, that's grace. But for some, it is a scandal. So that, we needed to look at that because, like I said, many of the newer versions of the Bible say that the passage, should not be here, but we want to affirm that it should be here, that this is indeed the word of the Lord. No question about it in my mind. So, but now let's walk through the passage together. We want to look at the scene itself. We want to look at the Savior in particular. We want to look at the accusers that are here. We want to look at Jesus dealing with the woman. Then we want to look at the woman's response to how Jesus deals with her. So let's look at the scene. What happened is after this dispute that's recorded in chapter 7 between the religious leaders, everyone went to his own house. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, spent the night there. Now, early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery, and when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act." So Jesus was teaching in the temple. Now, the reference here is to the precinct of the temple and these porticos that where the people would gather. So Jesus would often teach there. And so here it is in the morning, and he's got a crowd around him. He's teaching. And suddenly, the whole thing is disrupted by this band of men who come basically dragging this woman before Jesus and demanding that he pass a judgment upon her. Now, you can only imagine what a fearful moment this would have been for the woman. She's arrested, essentially, by these guys. So this is a band of self-appointed moral policemen. That's what they are. And they grab this woman, they take her and carry her there to the temple, and they put her right down before Jesus. So you can imagine that this would have been quite a frightening experience for her. And she was probably quite hysterical when she ended up there before Jesus. Their treatment of her was ruthless, it was heartless, it was merciless. And remember who these people are. They are the religious leaders of the day. They are the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the most devoted, Bible-believing, committed, people at the time. And as we pointed out before, not all of them had this hyper self-righteousness, but this band obviously did. So not only was the treatment ruthless and merciless, but notice the total injustice here. Because if the woman was indeed caught in the very act of adultery, as they said was the case, then you have to ask the question, well, where is the other person that she was engaged in adultery with? Why is there no man here? So you see that this is a completely unjust situation. But then John tells us that the whole thing was driven by deceit on the part of the leaders. The woman was just a pawn. What they were looking to do was they were looking to trap Jesus. And John tells us this. He says that, verse 4, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that she should be stoned, such should be stoned. But what do you say? This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. So what they were trying to do was trap Jesus between violating the state's authority or compromising with the Mosaic law and losing face with the people. So if Jesus says, do stone her, then he's now immediately in conflict with the state, with the Romans, because the Romans are the only ones that can call for a person's execution. So Jesus is usurping the state and they're seeking to get him in trouble with the authorities. But if Jesus says that we're to have mercy on her, then of course, notice what they said. Moses in the law said to stone her. So they're looking to set Jesus against Moses, and then popular opinion would hopefully turn against him. So that's the motive with these men. This is really what's happening here, and this is what they're doing. But it seems that they've trapped Jesus. And they, on many occasions, as we go through the Gospels, we find that they had sought to ensnare him. And it seems here that they maybe have trapped him. Years ago, I was reading the story of a man, the story of his conversion. The man's name is Arthur Katz. And he wrote a book called Ben Israel, Odyssey of a Modern Jew. Now, Arthur Katz was a left-wing radical back in the 60s. He was a Marxist. He was an atheist. He was a Jew. He was up in the Berkeley area back in those days. And yet in the course of events, he came to search out the New Testament. And in his book, Ben Israel, Odyssey of a Modern Jew, he tells the story of reading this passage and of the impact that it had on him. And as he's telling the story of reading the passage here, he's telling all of the suspense that he went through as he reads the story. Now, he's not a believer at this time, but he's a searcher. And listen to what he said. So he wrote this. He said, the law said the woman must be stoned. Yet Jesus had been teaching forgiveness. And earlier in the book, it actually said God sent not his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. Jesus, in his mind, Jesus was trapped. And so he goes on and he says, what would I say if I were Jesus? He says, I searched my mind, exhausting my resources of logic and reason, and finally conceded there was no answer. So he's reading this story, and in his book, he tells about how he got to this place in the story, and he just couldn't read it any further. He shut the book. It's like, no. At this point, he's being drawn to Jesus, and he feels like Jesus is in this trap. Now think about it. He's never read this story before. He doesn't know the outcome of it. So the suspense is too great for him. The fear is too great that Jesus is going to end up, you know, not being able to get out of this one. So he closes the book, but then he says, fully expecting the worst, I reopened the book and I read on. I remember reading the story years ago, and I remember he was on a ship somewhere, and he was, you know, I remember it was cold, and he was describing how he was all bundled up, and the wind was, and the spray was blowing in his face, but he just couldn't put this down. He was so captivated by it. So here at this point, he reopens the book, and he read on, and he said, I found Jesus bending over, poking his finger in the dirt. So we'll leave that for a moment. We'll come back to it in a second. So, but let's go back to the actual scene here. So we come to look at the Savior now. So they come, they bring the woman, they set her in the midst, they accuse her, they say she's been caught in the very act of adultery. Moses said, stone her. What do you say that we should do? And notice what Jesus does. It says that he stooped down, he wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear them. It's so interesting, the response of Jesus. As though he did not hear them. It's like he didn't really pay attention to them. And what I'm thinking is what the woman must have felt like at this point. Because, like I said, I'm sure she was hysterical. I'm sure she's absolutely fearful for her life. These guys were not messing around. They wanted to have her killed. And she doesn't know who Jesus is. She doesn't know if he's going to be the one to say, absolutely right, we got to kill her. Moses said to do it. So there she is in all of the hysteria, in all of the anxiety, in all of the fear. And they lay out the case. Moses said to stone her, what do you say? And he just acts like he doesn't hear them. It's fascinating to me. And I wonder if at this point there wasn't something in her own experience where maybe there was just sort of a calm that came over her, like, you know, maybe there's hope in this situation. We don't know. But the big question that has been asked that can never really be answered is, what was Jesus writing on the ground? I wish we knew, but we're not told. But we can speculate. Many have done so. Some say, well, you know, perhaps he was writing out the commandments. Maybe so. It is interesting the way John describes this when John says that he wrote on the ground with his finger. There's another place in the Bible where you find the finger of God writing something. And that is back in the law. It's back in Exodus. When God gave the commandments, it says that the commandments were written with the finger of God on stone. And so it's almost like John is connecting those two things. Like the one who wrote the law is the one who's writing on the ground. The one who's the author of the law is standing with these men accusing this woman of violating the law. Some have speculated that maybe Jesus even wrote the names of the individuals alongside of the particular commandment that they had violated. Now, we don't know. That's speculation. But the answer of Jesus was completely unanticipated, and it was irrefutable. And let me pick up with Arthur Katz. Because remember, he just can't bear to see where this is going to go. But he opens the book and he sees that Jesus answered them. And this is what he wrote. He said, and then came the answer, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Katz says, I gasped. A sword had been plunged deep into my own being. It was numbing and shocking, yet thrilling, because the answer was so utterly perfect. It defied cerebral examination. It cut across every major issue I had ever anguished upon in my life. Truth, justice, righteousness, integrity. I knew that what I had read transcended human knowledge and comprehension. It had to be divine. This was the turning point for this man, Arthur Katz. It was this story that turned him into a believer in Jesus as the Jewish Messiah. It was this story that impacted him. It is so impactful.
For the month of February, Back to Basics Radio is offering a book titled Why Grace Changes Everything by Chuck Smith. Have you ever thought about the simple phrase, God loves you? This just might be the most important truth you could ever grasp, that God has called us into a loving relationship with Himself. Unfortunately, many of us have been brought up to think that we need to earn God's love. In Chuck Smith's book, Why Grace Changes Everything, Pastor Chuck imparts years of wisdom from his own experiences, how he thought he had to work hard and deny his own desires for God to love him. But when he unlocked the secret of God's grace, this changed everything he ever thought about God. Come discover the book, Why Grace Changes Everything, by Pastor Chuck Smith. It's our gift to say thank you for your donation to Back to Basics. So we encourage you to call us right now at 0208-466-5365. And don't forget to visit backtobasicsradio.com, where you can find more resources or sign up for Pastor Brian's free email devotional. We'd also like to remind you that all of our other resources are waiting for you by dialing 0208-466-5365 or by writing us at Back to Basics Radio, P.O. Box 647, Bromley, Kent, BR14WQ. We'll continue tomorrow with more valuable insights from Pastor Brian as we continue our series, Jesus Encounters. Back to Basics is the preaching and teaching ministry of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.